Lecture number 8, meditation. From our discussion of the Noble Eightfold Path, it can be seen that the core of the Buddha's way to liberation consists in the practice of meditation. It was by meditation that the Buddha reached enlightenment himself, and it is only by meditation that those who follow his teaching can generate in their own mind the wisdom needed to reach enlightenment. There are two main types of meditation taught by the Buddha. One is called the development of serenity, samatha bhavana. The other is called the development of insight, vipassana bhavana. The word translated as meditation is bhavana, which means literally bringing into being, that is, development or cultivation. So the practice of serenity meditation, samatha bhavana, is actually the development of serenity. And the practice of vipassana bhavana, insight meditation, is the development of insight. The development of serenity aims specifically at developing samadhi. That is, a deep, concentrated state of mind in which the mind is unified, freed from discursive thoughts. This state of concentration brings inner serenity, inner calmness. But that state of serenity is not the ultimate value of this type of meditation in the Buddhist path. The real value of samadhi or concentration is to act as a basis for developing wisdom. As we saw in the last talk, the Eightfold Noble Path is divided into three stages: moral discipline, concentration, and wisdom. The root of all bondage and suffering is ignorance, lack of understanding things as they really are. The one factor that can cut off ignorance and issue directly in liberation is wisdom, or panya. But for wisdom to arise, the right conditions are needed. Wisdom can't arise in a mind that's scattered, disturbed by many stray thoughts, by distractions and desires. Wisdom can arise only in the concentrated mind, the mind that's been cleansed of all disturbing thoughts, the mind has been brought to a sharp point of focus, clear and precise. Thus, the practice of serenity meditation, samatha bhavana, aims at developing concentration as a foundation or basis for arousing wisdom, the wisdom which can cut off ignorance. The actual development of wisdom takes place through the other form of meditation, the vipassana bhavana, insight meditation, the development of insight. Insight meditation aims at seeing, at gaining direct insight into the real nature of things. This insight is the essential key to liberation in the Buddha's path. And this form of meditation is the type which wipes out all the illusions, the delusions, the wrong mental conceptions which are created by ignorance and which keep us in bondage. It's the insight meditation which illuminates phenomena for us just as they are, free from all distortions and projections. Now, serenity meditation is common to both Buddhist and non-Buddhist systems of practice. It was practiced in India long before the Buddha even appeared in the world. The states to which serenity meditation leads are the deep absorption, the jhanas, or the samadhis. And these are regarded as being very beautiful and lofty states of consciousness, very exalted attainments. However, from the Buddhist perspective, they are not essential to liberation. They are of value as providing a base for wisdom, but they are not indispensable. The Buddha mastered these types, these stages of attainment, when he was a bodhisattva before his own enlightenment. And though he reached the highest attainments of serenity, he found them inadequate. At best, they can serve as supports for developing wisdom, but in themselves, they are no guarantee for the attainment of wisdom. For Buddhism, the real way to awakening lies in the practice of insight meditation. Insight meditation is the unique discovery of the Buddha, the crest jewel of his path to deliverance. So, serenity meditation and insight meditation are concerned with purifying the mind from defilement, from greed, hatred, and delusion, and the other unwholesome states that arise from them. But the two types of meditation purify the mind in different ways. They clear up the defilements at different levels, and they are directed also to, principally to different types of defilements. To see how the two types differ, we have to understand that the defilements have a stratified structure. They fall into three layers. They operate at three levels, and they have to be dealt with in different ways at these different levels. The subtlest layer of the defilement is called the layer of latent tendencies, the anusayas. At this level, the defilements simply lie dormant at the base of the mind. They don't appear in active form as volatile forces at work in the mind. They just lie quietly below the surface of consciousness. But when we encounter experiences that strike us as either agreeable or disagreeable, or when we evaluate things and relate them to ourselves, then the defilements can be aroused from this condition of latency. They can wake up and rise to the next level where they appear in active form. This active form of defilements is called the stage of manifestation, pariyutana. At this second level, the defilement becomes a formative influence on the thought process. It motivates our thoughts, our attitudes, and our emotions. When, if the defilement gains still more power, if it reaches a point where we can no longer control it, then it reaches the third level, where it spills out in the form of some unwholesome action, some unwholesome deed of body or speech. This third level is called the stage of transgression, vipikamma. To give an example, we might be walking down the street, very calm and very happy. There's no trace at all of anger in our mind. Then suddenly we might meet somebody who displeases us, that we had some past quarrels with. When we see him, just when we get the impression of his face and body, then there might arise some impression of anger. And so the defilement of anger now comes to the surface. We become angry. As we get closer to him, we can no longer control our mind. So we burst out in some angry outburst. We speak to him in a nasty and offensive way. In this occurrence, we could see all three levels of the defilements at work. When we're walking down the street, very calm and happy, there's no anger at all present in the mind. But anger is still dormant in the consciousness as an anusaya, a latent tendency. When we get the impression of that antagonistic person, and then when we become angry in mind, then the latent tendency has risen up to the surface. Anger has reached the level of manifestation. Then when we can no longer control the anger and we break out in harsh speech, then the anger is moved from the level of manifestation to the level of transgression. It's motivated and unwholesome verbal deeds. Now, the three steps of the Buddha's path are designed to counteract the defilements at these three different levels. The first step, sila, moral discipline, prevents the defilements from reaching the stage of transgression. When we take the precept, we put a check on our actions of body and speech to ensure that they don't fall into the grip of the defilements, so they don't become a means of expressing greed, hatred, delusion, or their offshoots. But even when we're following the precepts carefully, the mind can still be overrun by the defilements occurring in a purely mental form, operating at the stage of manifestation, governing our thoughts, our emotions, and attitudes. To overcome the defilements at this level, we have to develop concentration, samadhi. When the mind becomes focused and concentrated in a wholesome way, then the active form of the defilements is checked. The defilements subside from the surface of the mind, pushed out by the force, the pure concentration. However, even though the defilements do not appear, still they will remain below at the level of latency, as potentialities able to spring up again in the future if they meet suitable conditions. Therefore, the work of concentration is not enough. It's not sufficient. What is necessary is to eliminate the defilements entirely, right down to the roots, right down to the level of latency. This is the work of wisdom, panya, developed by the practice of insight meditation. When insight is developed, when it reaches its highest point, then it issues in the wisdom of enlightenment. And this wisdom of enlightenment cuts off the defilements right at their source, at the bottom of the mind. Thus, the difference between serenity meditation and insight meditation can be understood in terms of the way they purify the mind. Serenity meditation purifies the mind from the defilements in their active form. It removes them from the level of manifestation. And it does this by suppressing the defilements. And here we have to say that the word suppression in Pali Vikambana shouldn't be confused with repression. Repression is an unconscious mechanism by which the thoughts and emotions are pushed out of awareness, usually with fear and aversion, and they still continue to operate below the surface in subliminal form. But suppression is a conscious process, a process by which we mindfully still the activity of the unwholesome state. We deliberately remove them from the surface with full awareness of what is taking place. And so in serenity meditation, we suppress the defilements, we remove them from the surface of the consciousness. But in contrast, insight meditation aims at purifying the mind by removing the latent tendencies. And it does this by cutting them off at the level of the root by means of wisdom. Also, there's a difference between the types of defilements with which the two kinds of meditation are principally concerned. Serenity meditation is concerned principally with removing the coarser defilements, such as greed, hatred, and certain of the coarser deluded states. In contrast, insight meditation is directed principally to the subtlest defilement, that is, to ignorance. It's intended to remove even the subtlest and finest rootless of ignorance. Now, there are two basic approaches to the systematic development of meditation. In both of these, the essential place belongs to the practice of insight meditation. The two approaches differ in the way they utilize concentration as the basis for insight. One approach is called the vehicle of serenity, samadhiyana. In this approach, we develop serenity to a very deep level, to a level of deep concentration, until the mind enters samadhi on a single object. Then by means of that concentration, we stabilize the mind on that object. We make the mind firm and steady and clear away the active form of defilement. Then, after developing this concentration, we use that concentration as a basis and turn the mind to develop insight. Then we go through the levels of insight meditation. So that is the approach called the vehicle of serenity. The other approach is called the vipassanayana, the vehicle of insight, or the method of dry insight. In this method, we do not aim to develop a deep concentration by fixing the mind on a single object. Instead, we start off directly with the practice of mindfulness, with the four foundations of mindfulness, contemplating the changing processes of the body, feelings, states of mind, and mind objects. But as we cultivate mindfulness, as we go on contemplating the changing process, we also develop an accompanying kind of concentration. This concentration doesn't reach the full depth and stillness of the concentration developed in the other approach, in the vehicle of serenity. This is a fluid, mobile kind of concentration, which runs alongside the development of insight. It's called momentary concentration. But it's not called this because it lasts only for one moment and then disappears, but rather because it flows along from moment to moment in the changing process of awareness. As it is cultivated moment by moment, it picks up momentum until it becomes strong enough to keep the defilements away and to allow insight wisdom to arise. Which approach is chosen between these two? That depends partly on the personal temperament of the meditator, partly on his circumstances. Some people feel the need to cultivate a strong level of concentration first. Others feel capable of going directly into insight practice. Also, sometimes we might need a teacher who emphasizes one method, sometimes a teacher who uses the other method. And then to take advantage of that teacher, we have to follow the method that he uses. Now we'll explain both forms of meditation briefly and then give some practical instructions. First, however, we should say a few words about the preliminaries to meditation. Buddhist meditation is a practice which belongs to the Buddhist tradition. It arises out of the Buddhist understanding of the nature of human existence, and it's directed to the goal made known by the Buddha, the attainment of Nibbana. Therefore, when meditation is taken up in the traditional context, practice begins with the act called going for refuge. Going for refuge means entrusting oneself to the guiding ideals of the Buddhist path. there are three guiding ideals: the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The Buddha is the enlightened one, the supreme person who by his own unaided effort discovered the way to deliverance. The Dhamma is the truth of liberation, the path that leads to the attainment of liberation, and the teaching that gives instructions about the path. The Sangha here is not the order of monks, as the term is usually understood, but it's the Aryan Sangha, that is, the community of noble disciples of the Buddha, those who have followed the path to the high levels of attainment and reached one of the stages of enlightenment. These three, the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, are called the three refuges, because they make possible complete deliverance from all of the dangers and sufferings of existence. The Buddha is compared to a wise physician who diagnoses our condition and prescribes a remedy. The Dhamma is like the medicine that he gives, and the Sangha is like the attendants who help us to get well. The most important of the three is the Dhamma. The Dhamma is the medicine, the actual refuge. And the act of entrusting oneself to these three, relying on them for guidance, is going for refuge. And the practice of meditation properly begins with the attitude of taking refuge. This is expressed through the standard formula in Pali: Buddhang saranang gacchami, Dhammang saranang gacchami, Sanghang saranang gacchami, Tudiyampi Buddhang saranang gacchami, Tudiyampi Dhammang saranang gacchami, Tudiyampi Sanghang saranang gacchami, Tadiyampi Buddhang saranang gacchami, Tadiyampi Dhammang saranang gacchami, Tadiyampi Sanghang saranang gacchami. I go for refuge to the Buddha. I go for refuge to the Dhamma. I go for refuge to the Sangha. A second time, I go for refuge to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. A third time, I go for refuge to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. The next preliminary after going for refuge is taking the precept, pledging to observe morally pure conduct. Moral discipline, sila, is needed primarily to hold in check the coarser expressions of the defilement, to prevent the defilement from motivating unethical action of body and speech. When we practice meditation, we're trying to purify the mind. And in order to clear the mind of the defilement, it's necessary to prevent the defilement from breaking out into unwholesome acts of body and speech. If we give way to the defilement and act with them as our motive, this will only involve us in a crossfire of aims. On the one hand, in meditation, we're aiming to purify the mind of the defilement. On the other hand, in our daily conduct, we're living under the sway of the defilement. And if we get caught in this crossfire, this will just frustrate our attempts to gain calm and insight, and it will destroy our efforts at concentration. So therefore, before undertaking the practice of meditation, we have to make the firm resolution to observe the five precepts, the the basic framework of moral discipline. That is, first, to abstain from taking life, from destroying life. Second, to abstain from taking what is not given, from stealing. Third, to abstain from unwholesome forms of sexual misconduct. That is, for lay people, from adultery, seduction, forced relations, promiscuous, meaningless relations, and so on. Fourth, to abstain from false speech or lying. And fifth, to abstain from taking intoxicants, liquors, drugs, and so on, which cause unclarity of mind. Sometimes during periods of intensive retreat, intensive meditation practice, lay meditators take up temporarily a more austere ethical code. This includes observing celibacy, brahmacharya, for the period of the retreat. Not eating after midday, just taking the main meal before midday and not eating any solids after that. Avoiding entertainments and personal adornments, and avoiding sleeping on a high bed, instead sleeping on the floor, in a sleeping bag, on a mattress on the floor. These activities themselves are not immoral, but to indulge in them causes distractions of the mind, which disrupt the work of meditation and drain energy that can be used more profitably to develop the mind during that precious period of the meditation retreat. And therefore, to strengthen their practice, lay meditators frequently observe these additional precepts. Okay, now we can discuss first the development of samadhi, concentration, by means of the practice of serenity meditation. Serenity meditation, as we said, aims specifically at developing concentration or samadhi. Concentration is defined as the wholesome unification of the mind. It's the collecting of the mind upon a single object, the focusing of the mind upon a single object. And one who sets out to develop concentration first selects a single object to be his primary meditation subject. The word meditation subject in Pali is kamatana, which means field of work. That's the field where he's doing his spiritual work, the meditation subject. And the text mention a variety of possible objects. Later tradition enumerates these as 40. We don't have to explain all 40 of them. But they include, for example, what are called the dasinas, that is, circular discs that represent the primary elements, earth, water, fire, and air, or discs, color discs, representing the primary colors. Also among the meditation subjects are the parts of the body, the three refuge objects, the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, the meditation on the in and out breathing, the divine abodes of loving kindness, compassion, and so on. Altogether 40 subjects. Out of these, the meditator will choose a single object, or if he has a teacher, his teacher will assign him a single object. And then when he begins his work, the meditator will try to focus his mind upon the single object, excluding all sensory impressions, all discursive thoughts, all the other countless mental distractions. Whatever arises, whatever comes up, he just lets it go and brings the mind back again and again to his basic meditation object. For example, if he's meditating on the breathing, then he'll bring the mind back to the touch sensation of the breath as it moves in and out. Whatever thoughts come up, he just notes them briefly and lets them go bringing the mind back over and over to the same focal point, the touch sensation of the breath. Now, as meditation progresses, various impediments can come up. When they come up, they obstruct his efforts. They prevent him from reaching deep concentration. The Buddha has gained a thorough familiarity with these impediments, and he's classified them into a set called the five hindrances, pancha-nivarana. The five hindrances are sensual desire, ill will, dullness and drowsiness, restlessness and worry, and doubt. The first hindrance is sensual desire. Sensual desire is the yearning and craving for the objects of the senses, for agreeable and delightful sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, as well as for the thoughts and images based on these. When these kinds of thoughts come up, then the hindrance of sensual desire has arisen. The second hindrance, ill will, includes all negative mental states: hatred, aversion, anger, hostility, discontent, depression, and so on. Sometimes ill will might be directed to people, sometimes to things, sometimes to situations. It takes many forms. The third hindrance is a compound, dullness and drowsiness. Dullness is mental inertia, rigidity and stiffness of mind. Drowsiness is sleepiness, lethargy, indolence, and so on. These two are combined as dullness and drowsiness. The fourth hindrance is restlessness and worry. Restlessness is the excited and agitated state of mind. Worry is the nagging sense of remorse and regret over things that we've done mistakenly in the past, over problems lurking ahead in the future. Then the fifth hindrance is doubt. This doesn't mean questions about the doctrine and discipline, but rather it's a kind of persistent uncertainty about the Buddha and his teaching, the inability to make up one's mind to follow the path, the inability to accept the Buddha as one's teacher, the Dhamma as one's teaching, the inability to commit oneself to the practice. These five hindrances, when they come up in the mind, prevent the deepening of calm and concentration. Therefore, the Buddha calls them hindrances. And in a very interesting simile, the Buddha compares each of these five hindrances to a particular impurity of water which prevents a person from seeing his reflection. If a person wants to see his reflection in a pool of water, the water has to be clear without any impurities. Now, sense desire is like water having many different colored paints on its surface. Sense pleasures seem beautiful and attractive, like brightly colored dyes. But if the surface of the water is colored with beautiful colored paint, you can see your reflection, just as you can gain concentration or insight if the mind is obsessed by sense desires. Ill will, that is like boiling water, water with bubbles rushing up to the surface and breaking moment by moment. If you try to see your reflection in boiling water, you won't succeed. Similarly, when the mind is boiling over with hatred, with anger and ill will, then you can gain calm and concentration. Then sloth and torpor are like water that's overgrown with moss. The moss is the symbol of stagnation, sliminess. And the moss prevents you from seeing your own reflection. And so sloth and torpor, or dullness and drowsiness, indicate a stagnant state of mind, a mind which is inert and rigid, can't move, can't allow calm and insight. Restlessness and worry, these are like the surface of water that's been churned up by strong winds, which break it into waves and ripples. When restlessness and worry pass through the mind, then they disturb the thought process. They cause many rippling thoughts that prevent calm and insight. Then doubt is like muddy water, water which is completely unclear, unable to give back a reflection. For concentration to be attained, the five hindrances have to be eliminated. And to eliminate them, the Buddha recommends a variety of methods. The first technique to be employed is simply to make a note of the hindrance when it arises, then to let it go without becoming disturbed by it, without feeding it with too much concern. If we follow the hindrance and latch onto it, then of course the hindrance will just grow and become stronger. But also if we become upset by it, if we become repelled by it and try to push it away, then also the hindrance will gain in strength and become persistent. But if we just make the mental notes of the hindrance and bring the mind back to the object, then it's likely that the hindrance will lose its momentum and will just subside. But if the hindrance still continues to crop up, another method that can be used is to focus attention on the hindrance itself, to observe it with mindfulness. Since the calm and clarity of mindfulness are incompatible with the mental disturbances, this method shuts out the hindrance and often succeeds in making it subside. Then when the hindrance subsides, the meditator can return to his primary object. But if the hindrance still comes up, if it proves to be really persistent, then we might have to drop the primary subject and take up a special measure directly opposed to the hindrance. Thus, the Buddha has given methods to counteract each of the five hindrances. But when sense desire arises and becomes persistent, then a helpful method is to meditate on the impermanence of the sense object, to see it as going up as something that's bound to be destroyed, that we're bound to be separated from it, and therefore it's no point becoming attached to it. Sometimes if other bodies become the source of sensual attachment, then we can just reflect briefly on the impure or unattractive nature of the body. See the body as a heap of bones and encompassed by a bag of skin filled with blood and with many organs and muscles and so on. When we reflect in that way, very often the hindrance of sense desire subsides. The antidote to ill will and aversion is to develop loving kindness towards other people, metta bhavana. This we will explain in greater detail later. And with regard to situations, to develop patience in the face of those situations, simply to accept them as the working out of our karma. The antidote to dullness and drowsiness, the Buddha has given several methods to deal with them. One is to develop a perception of light, to meditate on a bright light. Another method is to practice walking meditation, to get up and walk back and forth vigorously, and that will sometimes stimulate the mind. Sometimes even washing the face or going out into the cold air is helpful. Any of these methods can help dispel dullness and drowsiness. To get rid of restlessness and worry, a helpful method is to practice mindfulness of breathing, to narrow down the attention and focus on a single, very simple object, which will calm down the restless waves of thought. Also, it's very helpful to eliminate worry and mental disturbance is meditating on the figure of the Buddha, seeing the sublime, peaceful, serene figure of the Buddha. Then to get rid of doubt, sometimes to get rid of doubt, we have to lay aside our meditation and interrogate, to ask questions, to to study. Sometimes also devotional practices are helpful. And also what's sometimes needed is just a strong resolution to commit oneself to the practice and to stay with it without continually surrendering to all of the questions that come up, to all the suspicions and uncertainties, but just to stick with the method and to suspend the doubt, to see how things work out as we progress with the practice. Now, as the meditator continues with his practice of serenity meditation, continues developing concentration, he arouses in his mind five mental factors, which are repeatedly strengthened and reinforced by his efforts. These mental factors are called the five factors of absorption, the five jhana factors. They are initial application, sustained application, rapture, happiness, and one-pointedness. Initial application, vitakka, is the mental factor of applying the mind to the object. It is said to have the function of lifting the mind up and directing it to the object. It makes the mind strike again and again at the object. The second factor, sustained application, is the continuation of that. It's the factor of continued pressure on the object. This factor keeps the mind occupied with the object, examining it, applying the mind again and again to the object, keeping the mind anchored on the object. The difference between initial application and sustained application is illustrated in the text in this way. Initial application is like the striking of a bell. Sustained application is like the reverberation of the bell. Or initial application is like a bird striking its wings to go up into the air. Sustained application is like the bird continuing in flight. Initial application is gross. Sustained application is subtle. Initial application brings the mind to the object. Sustained application fixes the mind on the object. Then the third factor is rapture of piti. This is pleasurable interest in the object. Interest which can range all the way from a momentary thrill of delight with the practice of meditation, all the way up to overwhelming ecstasy, where the body and mind are flooded with rapture, with ecstasy. Then the fourth factor of absorption is happiness or bliss, sukha. Happiness is the pleasant feeling that accompanies the practice. It's something that's somewhat different from rapture. Happiness is a feeling, whereas rapture is a full state of mind. And happiness begins as a new kind of pleasure, pleasure which is purer and more peaceful than sense pleasure. And then as it's developed, it rises up to the height of bliss, this very pure, tranquil bliss.